What will be the miry clay? What will be the glue that will bind together otherwise disparate, oftentimes down through history, bickering, arguing, even warring nations, which will bring them together for a short time? But one powerful, charismatic, spiritual figure who will actually claim to have the powers of God, and who for a brief period of time will be able to prove it to them by miracles which they cannot gainsay.
For 50 years, one man has brought you the plain truth and let the chips fall where they may. And now, Garner Ted Armstrong.
When you consider all of Europe at the vastly disparate economies, languages, religion, culture, tradition, and history of nations such as Germany and France, Germany and Italy, Italy and Greece, Greece and perhaps Belgium, France and Holland, Holland and Italy. Vast differences, but there is a similarity. There is a thread throughout all of those European countries where there is commonality. And we're going to see in a few minutes that the biblical prophecy show that there is something that is called a gooey substance, that instead of being a true glue that is going to hold together 10 nations for any indeterminate period of time, there is going to be something called miry clay mixed with iron. But iron and clay are not mixed together. And a prophecy that says there is going to be 10 nations, there will be 10 nations who will be unified together only for a short period of time. And we'll be discussing exactly what will be the unifying agent which will bring that about. When Mr. Fischer, who is the German foreign minister, was asked, "Are you going to need or want a single European army?" Here was his answer. "If it is going to turn into a full union, then one day foreign and defense policy will also have to become community tasks." You hear that again? Foreign policy, defense policy will have to become community tasks. In other words, the answer is yes, there will be a united European army. He acknowledged this, that I just related to, that Europeans would never become a homogeneous nation state because of differences such as peculiarities in language, history, prejudices, passions, and old animosities. But the Franco-German cooperation is without precedent, and they have any number of areas of cooperation that does not include Britain. But a united Europe is so what? Ho-hum. Who cares? Isn't it what we've wanted all along? And you know, strangely, that is exactly the attitude in the White House and indeed in the Pentagon. When Senator Sasser went to the Middle East quite some time ago and told us only a month before the Arabs imposed the OPEC oil embargo that the Arabs would never use oil as a political weapon, that same gentleman was talking about how the Germans have been able to dwell underneath the American nuclear umbrella and was talking about Europe pulling its fair share. And they want Japan to begin to pull its fair share because they say Japan has been able in all of these post-World War II years to dwell under the American nuclear umbrella. For many, many years, I said before live audiences and over radio and television that there would either come a rewriting or a reinterpretation of both the Japanese and German constitutions that were crafted in post-World War II periods of time. Another little point, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, I said time and again, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, Italy, and so on will be a part eventually of a United States of Europe because these are the nations which were always a part of the Holy Roman Empire. How could I have known in 1958, in 1963, 1967, 1969, 1972, 1975, long before the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union backed out of Europe and the Warsaw Pact came apart, that those nations in Eastern Europe would be a part of a coming United States of Europe? Well, I knew that because of Bible prophecy. I knew that because throughout all of the gradual Cold War years of the development of American and British hegemony through NATO ever increasingly in Western Europe, and from the economic picture and from the history of the entire area, but especially from biblical prophecy and from the bizarre repetition of the creation of a militarized Holy Roman Empire in the same old area where it was mostly Germanic from the time of Otto the Great and the Habsburgs to Bismarck. And of course, even though Napoleon was a Corsican, he was also the head of the Holy Roman Empire during the revival under his empire, when he held sway over all of Europe and was about to attack England with something like 40,000 flat-bottom boats and was not able to do so. You may think this has nothing whatsoever to do with an ancient prophecy found in the second chapter of the book of Daniel, but I want to turn there right quickly. This is the interpretation by Daniel of a dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had, and all of you are very familiar with it. You ought to read what some of the Bible commentaries say about it, of course, and some of the claims of such as the Roman Catholic Church and even, in fact, the Anglican Church about the meaning of that prophecy, because they believe it had to do with the Christianization of the old pagan Roman Empire and the creation of the Holy Roman Empire. They think it had to do with the time of Charlemagne, from that time thereafter, when the popes always crowned the kings of Europe. And some people will actually look you in the eye and tell you that the kingdom of God was established back then, and gradually, as Christianity has grown, is eventually going to be established on this earth. It had been really assumed by many people that during the days of Pax Romana, or the imposition of peace through the entire known world of Europe by the Roman Empire, that the Christianization, that is putting a papal crown atop the kings of Europe, was actually the establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth. I won't read the image and what he saw, but read the interpretation beginning in verse 36 of Daniel 2. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and fowls of the heaven, is he given into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Therefore, king and kingdom are synonymous. Now, the vision that he saw, you're familiar with. It's listed in verse 32, 3, and 4 of this chapter, and we're coming to another description of it here. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to you. Interesting, too, because most people think the opposite is true. They think that ancient Babylon would have been very inferior, almost savage, that then there would have been an advance in Persian civilization, in art and literature and science and so on. Then there would have been a much greater advance in Greco-Macedonian times under Alexander, and later on Laomedon in Syria, Ptolemy Soter in Egypt, and so on. And then they think it would have been a much greater advance by the time Rome ruled and held sway. The interpretation of this vision shows that the exact opposite was true. I have seen whole huge segments of the Ishtar Gate of ancient Babylon in the Berlin Museum. And there they are with the baked enamel with the gorgeous colors still there. And when you look into Halley's Bible Handbook and read about ancient Babylon, and one of the seven wonders of the world were the Hanging Gardens in Babylon, and the size of that wall, where three chariots could ride abreast over that entire wall, and in the corners it was big enough for them to turn around on a full run. Then there was an interior wall inside of that, and that the exterior wall was more than 100 feet high. And you read about how great Babylon became and the fact that it was served by a river which flowed right completely underneath the river gate and through the city, so they had, they thought, a perennial supply of water. Of course, that's exactly how Cyrus and Darius, the Medo-Persian Empire, caused their fall, which was to work and work and work way upstream and eventually divert the river and walk in on the night of Belshazzar's drunken feast, dry shod, and surprise the city and overwhelm it. But that's for another subject, and that has to do with history, not prophecy. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, that was the Persian Empire, another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, the known earth. And a lot of people don't know that Alexander the Great conquered all the way from what he called the Gates of Hercules, which would be Algeciras, which is right there where the Rock of Gibraltar is on the peninsula across from Africa in Spain. The Iberian, by the way, Iberian Peninsula, if that strikes a note in your mind. Hebrew, Iber, Iberian. Anyway, but all the way from there to India. And of course, died at age 31, I think, sobbing because it was no more of the world to conquer. And then, of course, along came Rome. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And again, another little bit of insight. Gold is extremely precious. Silver is precious, but less so by far. Brass is a very valuable alloy, but nowhere near as precious as gold, but much harder. So each metal successively grows harder and less malleable, less flexible, and also of lower value, cheaper, but it's also more brittle and therefore more easily broken. So there's some insight in that as well. And whereas, as you saw, the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly weak. The word broken is an error. I have a margin and it says brittle or weak. Now, anyone dealing in metallurgy who was going to form anything from backyard lawn furniture to the pedestal on a microphone would know that if you are going to pour molten iron into a mold and you've got clay in there, that the iron is going to cook the clay, and the clay is going to end up with all kinds of pockets in the iron, and it is a very, very bad mixture. You're going to have a very poor product that will break very easily. And that is exactly what is intended here. Whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay.
If you'd like more on the message you're watching, call for your free copy of Iron and Clay, compiled from some of the best of Garner Ted Armstrong, and this compelling audio tape, Emerging Beast Power. You'll also receive the current edition of 21st Century Watch, which includes the dangerous controversy over the Temple Mount and the new anti-Semitism in Europe, a scorecard on what to look for in world events, and China, rising Asian powerhouse. All three items are yours free when you call 903-561-7070.
Now turn to Revelation, the 17th chapter again. And this time we'll peruse that a little bit and then go to the 18th chapter as well. As I said last time, if you only had the three verses, 12 through 14, you would know there are 10 kings, which will coalesce together only a short while, that they have one policy, that they pool all their resources and their military, and that they will, verse 14, make war with the Lamb. So what's the time setting? At the time of the second coming of Christ. And again, you come up to this either-or statement that either the Bible is true, and either these prophecies are accurate or they are not. And the Bible isn't true. But if there is a God, and if this is the Word of God, and if the Bible is true and these prophecies are going to come to pass, then you know this. And I don't care where you look around the world for them, whether you start in Asia and try to come up with China, Japan, and then where do you go from there? Bangladesh? Where do you go from there? Indonesia? China is mostly Buddhist and Confucianist. And Japan is mostly Buddhist, but they have a nationalistic kind of Buddhism, as well as sun worship, but it's called Soka Gakkai. And Indonesia is Islamic. The Philippines, they're mostly Irish, I should say Roman Catholic. Where are you going to find 10 nations whose borders probably are juxtaposed, are together, where 10 nations would coalesce into one gigantic power called a great beast, which is going to fight Christ that is coming? America, Mexico, Canada, and Honduras? Where are you going to look? You've only got one world to search. Where are you going to search? Bolivia, Ecuador? Where are you going to look for 10 nations? And where are you going to look in history for nations that have in the past been warring, bickering, disagreeing nations which have only been brought together at the behest of a great religious leader? It's interesting material. Look at the 17th chapter. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying, come hither, and I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of fornication. Now, drunkenness is spiritual drunkenness, and the fornication is simply having concourse as a political arrangement or agreement, as well as economic arrangements and agreements, with a state church instead of really, truly a church as any church ought to be structured. Now, in coming to the description of that woman, in verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet colored beast. Now, if the woman sits upon the beast, there's probably a saddle there and maybe a bridle. When you sit upon a beast, when a man or a woman sits upon a horse, that means that she is riding, that means she is guiding, or she is controlling the horse. So she is sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And you can let your imagination run wild with that. I won't bother. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Mystery, the mother of harlots. Now, who are her daughters? This is a church that has daughters. And those daughters came out of her in protest. If you'll keep your place right there, I want to go to the 47th chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah 47, right quickly, which gives a description of this same woman and some of her boasts and what she says. And it also talks about her daughters. And I think it's fascinating because you know of only one country in all of history which is called the Fatherland. And you know of only one church which is called the Mother Church. You know, Russia is called the Mother Church. Not the motherland is Russia. It's called the Rodina in Russian, means the motherland. Germany is called the fatherland. All nations in history are spoken of as she. They always put that upon them, I guess because of Latin and after that French and so on. They put the gender, like even in the Latin language, like a table or a chair is feminine in gender, where the ceiling is masculine in gender. Don't ask me why. El techo, la silla. I don't know. But anyway, that's the way they are assigned. So, in chapter 47, verse 1, come down and sit in the dust. In other words, come off of your throne, come away from the pearls, the gold, and the jewels, and just sit in the dirt of the ground, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground, there is no throne anymore, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. All the description here then is, it describes a woman who has been living in fabulous riches, who suddenly is reduced to task work, and even becomes completely naked. Now, in verse 6, I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand. You did show them no mercy. Upon the ancient have you very heavily laid your yoke. And you said, I shall be a lady forever. So that you did not lay these things to your heart, neither did you remember the latter end of it. Now therefore hear this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwell carelessly, and say in your heart, I am, and none else beside me. And that is a common claim. Of course, there again you hear the words of Christ before Abraham was, I am, and what the member of the divine Elohim said to Moses at the burning bush, I am. So when you look at 2 Thessalonians 2, that this great false prophet is going to sit in the temple of God, claiming that he is God, that may be a statement which will yet be heard in world news. And none else beside me. Do the Catholics acknowledge the Protestants as being valid? No. Do the Catholics acknowledge the Greek Orthodox Church as being really valid? No. They're making overtures toward healing the wound and getting back together. And even the Archbishop of Canterbury has met this current pope. This current pope has had private sessions with the Archbishop or the Great Patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church and has had private meetings with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And for the first time in all of history, there is, under the aegis of the Israeli government, an actual ambassador at the same level as the ambassador to the United States, the ambassador to the United Kingdom, the ambassador to Germany. And there are Israeli ambassadors all over the world. There's also an Israeli ambassador to the Vatican. And there's a Vatican ambassador in Jerusalem to Israel. Brand new. Only about 3.5 years old. I am. No, they do not acknowledge that they're second best. They don't acknowledge that there's anybody else. They are the one and the only true church, they say. It's in every bit of their literature and every one of their pronunciations. It's exactly their very, you know, foremost statement that they are the one universal church, the one true church Jesus built, the one church of which Peter was the first pope, and every one of the popes are supposed to be St. Peter's successors. None else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their perfection for the multitude of your sorceries and for the great abundance of your enchantments. I won't read it all, but that evil is going to come upon them, and we can read about that back in the 18th chapter of the book, and the last few verses, really, the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. Let's turn back to Revelation 17. While you're turning there, let me remind you that all emperors, commencing with Charlemagne, all the way down to very recent times, were crowned by the Pope. The Pope himself wears a papal crown. I have seen many of the crowns, including the one that is worn currently by the current popes today in the Vatican Museum. And contrary to what the Seventh-day Adventists say, there is no statement on it that adds up to 666. They would like that to be so. I've seen the crowns. I stared at them. I tried any way I could to find any letters or numerals or numbers that would come out that way. It's just not there. It'd be nice if it were, but it's not. So I'm not going to repeat that fable. That is not necessary to identify who these people are or the historical or prophetical significance. The Pope wears a crown. What is a crown? It's called a diadem, isn't it? And it's a symbol of what? Well, of absolute authority, the symbol of a king. Why would a religious leader wear a crown? Are church leaders supposed to wear a crown? Here's a quotation I just copied out of the Catholic Encyclopedia that I read extensively this morning. Quote, Charlemagne was solemnly crowned at St. Peter's in Rome by Pope Leo III on Christmas Day 800. I continue the quote, he, that is Charlemagne, was met in state outside the walls and escorted to St. Peter's. Next came the reception by the Pope, who sat enthroned and surrounded by his cardinals at the head of the steps before St. Peter's. And there the emperor, after kissing the Pope's foot, took the coronation oath. Quote, in the name of Christ, I, the emperor, promise, undertake, and protest in the presence of God and blessed Peter the Apostle that I will be the protector and defender of the Holy Roman Church in all ways that I can be of help, in omnibus utilitabibus, so far as I shall be supported by the divine aid, according to my knowledge and ability. This undertaking, which was at first clearly not an oath in form, they go on to say, was afterwards strengthened by a number of added clauses. For instance, the words, quote, I swear upon the holy gospels, end quote, or again by an explicit promise of fealty to the reigning pope by name and to his successors. One of the most famous paintings in all of history is in the Louvre, which I have seen on a number of occasions. It is huge. It is almost as big as, well, it's bigger than that wall, I guess. And all the figures are almost life-size, and there are dozens of them. And it's a picture of the interior of Notre Dame in Paris. And there is the Pope, and there are the College of Cardinals, and there are all the dignitaries and people with their spears and their shepherd's crook standing around. And here is Napoleon, and there is Josephine. And the look on the Pope's face is interesting, because Napoleon is in the process of snatching the crown out of the Pope's hands and jamming it on his own head. And then he took the crown and he jammed it on Josephine's head. He wanted to show the Pope who was really in charge. But they were in the process of Napoleon being coronated by the Pope. It's a very famous painting. There is a woodcut replica of it in the Catholic Encyclopedia that I just saw again this morning, but I've seen the original, and it is great art, a great moment in history, I suppose, in one way. But nevertheless, it is illustrative of what I'm talking about.
If you'd like more on the message you're watching, call for your free copy of Iron and Clay, compiled from some of the best of Garner Ted Armstrong, and this compelling audio tape, Emerging Beast Power. You'll also receive the current edition of 21st Century Watch, which includes the dangerous controversy over the Temple Mount and the new anti-Semitism in Europe, a scorecard on what to look for in world events, and China, rising Asian powerhouse. All three items are yours free when you call 903-561-7070.
Now, in Revelation, the 17th chapter, and in verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. All we know for sure is it is a short time. Now, verse 15, and remember the image that we saw in Daniel 2. The waters which you saw where the whore sitteth are peoples, that's different peoples, different races, and multitudes, gigantic populations, and nations, and tongues. Sometimes nations, which are political entities, involve far more than one ethnic entity, don't they? It's commonplace and it's caused an awful lot of problems. Now, verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked. What do we read in Isaiah 47? I shall not know the loss of children. I will never know widowhood. I shall always sit as a queen. Come and get thou into the dust, O harlot daughter of Babylon. There is no more throne. And eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. What will be the miry clay? What will be the glue that will bind together otherwise disparate, oftentimes down through history, bickering, arguing, even warring nations which will bring them together for a short time? But one powerful, charismatic, spiritual figure who will actually claim to have the powers of God and who for a brief period of time will be able to prove it to them by miracles which they cannot gainsay.
If you'd like more on the message you're watching, call for your free copy of Iron and Clay, compiled from some of the best of Garner Ted Armstrong, and this compelling audio tape, Emerging Beast Power. You'll also receive the current edition of 21st Century Watch, which includes the dangerous controversy over the Temple Mount and the new anti-Semitism in Europe, a scorecard on what to look for in world events, and China, rising Asian powerhouse. All three items are yours free when you call 903-561-7070.